My name is Steve Lamb, and this is Darren, and we're going to have some fun. First question. When you make an amend, do you ask for forgiveness? The short answer for that is, for me personally, no. I never ask for forgiveness. But interestingly enough, one of the topics of the session next morning is on acceptance and forgiveness. How about you? Do you ask for forgiveness, Darren?
I do.
You do?
I do ask for forgiveness. It's my belief that I'm there to try and lighten their load. It's my belief that during...
Yeah!
Bob, will you please forgive me? My sponsor told me that it's my job to lighten their load. I'm not there to relieve me, to fix my conscience that whilst, you know, I don't want to go to the grave and meet my maker having all these things unfinished, I'm trying to lighten their load. So I do ask for forgiveness.
I just want to point out that no one ever asks me to get closer to the microphone.
Hello. Is that better, Bob? Sorry, Scott, down the back. My name's Darren. I'm an alcoholic. How do you find your true self? It's a tough question. There's a great book. Steve talked about it earlier. Immortal Diamond by Father Richard Rohr. It's certainly, I ran a 3-month workshop on that book, and they're really short, chapters. So, you know, there's little 2-3 page chapters, and during that process, I certainly got more in touch with what's not me. Got more in touch with the fact that we're all one. That we're the only one here. It's certainly not my ego. It's that quiet voice deep down inside. Steve?
Well, my response is probably a little less fluffy.
Why, thank you.
I'll be here all weekend, brother. Don't worry about it. I'm here for you. I believe that if you want to find your true self, sponsor another man. And the reason why I say that is because it has been my experience that if you take another man through the book, you will have to ascertain, determine, and explain the experience that you have had in Alcoholics Anonymous and that you continue to have in Alcoholics Anonymous. My favorite line in the 12 and 12 is on page 57. It goes like this. Until we had talked with complete candor of our conflicts and had listened to someone else do the same thing, we still didn't belong. It's this concept of anxious apartness, this concept of separation. Bill talked about it this morning. I talked about it last night. Chuck Chamberlain was all over it. It's a false illusion. It's a delusion. So until I talk with complete candor of my conflicts, until I'd given Michael my fifth step, and this is in a very important and, had listened to my first fifth step, listened to someone else do the same thing, I still didn't believe that I belonged. I still didn't feel like I was inside the circle. I certainly couldn't realize it, and I definitely couldn't demonstrate it. But once you have that interaction, that relationship with another man, and you go through that process, that's when you find your true self. The next question is, have you any secrets you haven't discussed with your sponsor? If so, what is that secret?
So you won't tell your sponsor, but you're going to tell 200 men. Is this recorded, Scott?
I don't think that there's any secrets that I haven't talked to my sponsor about. I really don't. I will tell you, at first, I was very, very nervous about doing a lot of my fifth step with my sponsor, particularly about a lot of the stuff that I'd done in the military. But I did do that. And I don't think that things have come up that I haven't talked to him about. That's not the nature of our relationship. That's why I think that that sponsor-sponsee relationship is so important. I think it's also important, though, to share some of those secrets with at least some of the guys that you sponsor, because that seems to help a little bit with the right-sizedness of it, the humility of it, so that it's not just between me and my sponsor. It's a family and it's a community. It's not a big community. I don't share these things with everybody. But I share them with a few select few. And I just have not been a person to keep those type of secrets. I will tell you, though, there's been times when I haven't been aware of something. Like I talked about the issue that I had with the insurance fraud. It wasn't a secret because I wasn't aware of it. As soon as I found out about it, I told him about it, which I regretted immediately after doing that. But, I mean, I don't keep secrets from him. Yeah.
The answer's no, and very, very similar to you. We've all got that list of 10 things we're taking to the grave with us, right, when we arrive. And I wrote that inventory. I shared it with that. It was the first living human being that I shared that list with. I don't know why I did it. Maybe it was desperation, but I felt like it needed to be done. You know, some of those things were, I'd stolen my mother's purse. Now, some people might just take the cash out and put the purse back, but I didn't want her to think that it was me, so I threw the purse and all the contents away. There were private letters in there, driver's license, credit cards, photos that can't be replaced. And I thought I was the lowest of the low that would do something like that. And I shared that with that man. And there were lots of other things. Martin, I won't share one of the things because I don't want to repulse you like I did 3 years ago. But my sponsor made it okay. He shared similar stories. And I got to rejoin the human race. Right now, I don't knowingly have any secrets from my sponsor. There were times at different points in my recovery where I knowingly was keeping secrets. Hands up whether you'd let someone in this room kick you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hands up. Hands up. If you would willingly let someone kick you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. No way. I was kicking me out, though. I was backing out one step at a time by keeping these secrets. And I eventually needed to own up, put my hand up, and share this stuff that I was up to that just wasn't in keeping with what I thought card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous should be up to. Shall I grab another one?
Yeah, but that brings up a good point. I mean, you mentioned the fact that your sponsor told you some stuff before, and that happened with me also, and that's suggested in our literature that you actually, when you sit down with a man, it's always a good idea before that fifth step. I think it's a good idea to say a little prayer. I also think it's a good idea to tell him a couple of things about yourself. Because a lot of times we tend to think that we're the only one, that we're the only one that could have possibly done that. And that is just not true. I've listened to a lot of inventories, okay? And I've never heard anything that I haven't heard from other people. We just tend to think we're really unique. And that really goes right back to that sense of separation. We feel like we're separate and apart from everybody. And that, you know, I can't tell him this. He won't understand. And he may not have that specific experience, but I guarantee you that he'll understand. And I guarantee you if he's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, he knows somebody that's done the same thing. And if you've got a persistent recidivist problem with something, if he's been around a while, he'll know, hey, you should go talk to Barry or Jerry or Mark or John because they went through that. And that's one of the best things about Alcoholics Anonymous is it is a very large community. And we've done a lot of bizarre stuff. And there's always somebody out there that's done what you've done. Always.
Next question. How do I know if I'm doing it right? In my opinion, there's almost no way of doing it wrong. In my early days, my sponsor didn't take me through this book. He didn't really know how to take me through the steps because he hadn't been through the steps himself. But I was desperate. I was doing 10 meetings a week. I started writing inventory anyway. I shared it with the man. With his help, started to make amends. 3 years sober, I went through the book. I thought I finally found the right way. Was it? Not necessarily. It was great. It worked, just like the first way worked. At 14 years sober, I got a new sponsor. He took me through this book a different way. I found out, oh my God, there's more than one way. There's hundreds of ways. I think it's about where I'm coming from. Do I really want this thing? Like, you know, trying to pray is praying. Trying to do this with everything I've got, I'm doing it. Steve?
Yeah. How do I know if I'm doing it right? I think a good initial general indication is if you continue to not drink. We don't have a lot of rules in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's kind of a big one, the not drinking one. We're really kind of a big fan of the not drinking thing, okay? But the question really goes to, I'm not feeling right. And if you're asking the question, maybe you're not doing it right because you're not feeling comfortable. You should feel comfortable. You should be able to put your head on the pillow and feel comfortable with what you're doing. And my experience is the more you get out of your self-concern about yourself, the better off you'll be. That's why I always suggest that you work with other people, that you sponsor. If you can't sponsor, do a panel. Go to a rehab or a treatment center. Talk to a newcomer. I mean, if you're really having a hard time, all you got to do is ask a newcomer what he's thinking about. That's a tremendous source of entertainment. You know, that'll get you out of yourself for quite some time. The point is to get yourself out of yourself. And none of this makes any sense because we talk a lot about service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, when I was new, that sounded like work. You know, I remember my sponsor originally, one of the things he told me to do is he said, I want you to pick this guy up in Culver City and take him to the meeting. I don't like that guy. I know you don't like that guy. Pick him up, take him to the meeting. So I'm picking up this guy and taking him to the meeting, and I'm listening to him complain the whole way from Culver City to the meeting, which is about 25 minutes. At first it was annoying as hell, and then I realized that for 25 minutes I didn't think about me at all. And then that guy had the audacity to ask somebody else to take him to the meeting. That's my guy. You know, that's my guy. That's my 25th. That's mine. You know, and it's just, it's so bizarre because none of this makes any sense until you do it. But the more you can get out of your selfishness and self-centeredness, although we usually don't think so, the better off we'll be. What is something you do with guys after they have worked the 12 steps? I guess there's two ways to look at this. First of all, I don't think we've ever worked the 12 steps. I think you've gone through the 12 step. Once you're in the 12th step, you recycle back through. You do 10, 11, and 12. You can't do 10, 11, and 12 without doing 1 through 9. But once they've gone through and they're practicing the principles and they're trying to carry the message, I encourage them to keep carrying the message and to try to find somebody to sponsor. I think one of my biggest jobs when I take a guy through the book is to allow him the opportunity to then take the next guy through the book. So that's what I do. You know, I know if you're new and you're thinking that there's stripper poles and stuff like that involved. No, that's not what I do. What I do is tell them that, you know, remember when we had that conversation, when I started taking you through the steps and I told you that this was so you could take somebody else through the steps? It's time. I tell them it's time.
Awesome. I think I've got the soft one of these again. I don't know.
You are flaccid. About. I can't help you on that one, brother. I don't
it's
know.
Very
what to tell
flaccid.
You. Yes.
I don't know what the problem is. If I can start at the start, when I have a new guy, I don't take him straight to the book in week one. I know some of you do, but I don't. I give him a list of daily things to do, and on that list is he rings me. And if I don't pick up, he just lets me know how he's done with those daily things. Write a gratitude list, pray, read something from the book, get to a meeting. And I get a sense over that first week, you know, A, whether he rings me, whether he picks up when I ring him, where he's at in that first week. I then make an appointment with him to come round and we read the book together, much the same way that we've already talked about this weekend, and that works really great. Towards the end of that first revolution, I set up a weekly call time with the guy. So that's part of what happens after we've gone through the book. And I'm encouraging him to sponsor people. If you're like me and you're going to lots of panels and you're at the home group and standing at the door, come to the home group. Help me put the chairs out. He's the guy standing with me at the door, so that I can throw him the next crazy guy that looks way too crazy for me. And you know, it doesn't matter. I'm here. I'm holding your hand while you're sponsoring the new guy. Ring me if there's something that you don't, you know, that you're not clear on. And usually what happens the first time they're going through the book with a sponsee, every week in that weekly call time, I'm going to do We Agnostics this week. Remind me, what are the key things you want me to call out? And it works really well. So yeah.
Want me to grab another one?
Yes.
Can you speak to the relationship ideal process and the application of it? I assume you're talking about the sexual ideal. It says fourth step in brackets. Yep. So after I finished the third inventory, my sponsor asked me to go away and write an ideal for my future sex life. And it kind of looked a little bit like this. I want to be in a monogamous relationship. I want to be a dad. I want to be kind and loving. One of the agreements that Jody and I had was around what the word commitment had, and that was in my ideal. A commitment isn't a commitment until I don't want to do it anymore. Up until that point, it's fun. So I'm going to remain committed, except if two things happen, physical or verbal abuse. And Jody and I made that commitment really early in our relationship that neither one of us would abuse the other. And if you, I don't know what the dictionary definition of the word abuse is, she might swear at me. She does that a fair bit, actually. When she does, she might say stuff off, but use a different word. She might use that word and stomp her feet. But she doesn't say stuff off, you fat, ugly, so and so. And that's when it starts to enter into abuse. And in the 20 years we've been together, neither one of us have abused the other. So because there was a lot of that in my drinking, that was in my ideal for my future sex life, that I didn't want to be abusive anymore and that I wouldn't stand by someone else abusing me. Steve?
Yeah, my ideal was very similar. It was also monogamous, and it was that I be in a kind, supporting, and loving relationship. And I did a little bit different because my sponsor asked me to ask what I wanted for myself, and that's what I wanted for myself. And then he said, okay, now that's what you need to be. That's who you need to be. You need to act in that way. Barkley's acting as the fluffer, just in case you want to know.
Oh, warm-up guy.
Yeah. Okay, all right. He's suffering from the delusion that he's not a fluffer, but we're just going to go with that. Okay. But then I was supposed to act accordingly, which was kind of a shock to me. I thought this was what I was supposed to get, not who I was supposed to be. And he explained that if that's who I was, if that's who I could be, that's what I would attract, and that's what I would have. That's been my experience. The thing that I find kind of interesting about this, though, is I've sponsored a lot of guys. I've heard a lot of sexual inventories. I've heard many guys come back with their sexual ideal. Often it is not mine.
Mm.
That is none of my business.
Mm.
You know, we're not the arbiter of their sexual conduct. The point is, I want them to be able to put their head on the pillow and be comfortable, whatever their sexual ideal is. I mean, I had a guy one time, this was a young guy. He'd never dated. He'd only been with women who were, the nice phrase is strawberries. You might have heard them referred to as crack whores, okay? And his whole background, his whole sexual relationship before had been with strawberries. He'd always paid for sex with cocaine. And his sexual ideal was he wanted to have a monogamous relationship, and he wanted to have kids, and he wanted to have a similar relationship to what I have with my wife. But this is a guy that when we would be at a meeting and a woman would come up and talk to me, he would run away. He was terrified. He couldn't deal with them. So I suggested, like the book says, why don't you pray and meditate and ask God for guidance and direction and maybe come up with a plan of action on how to effectuate this ideal. And he did. And he came to me and he said, well, I got it. God talked to me. I know what I'm going to do. I'm like, okay, what is that? He says, well, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to start out with prostitutes. And then I'm going to work down to massage parlors that are full service, and then I'm going to work down to massage parlors that are rub and tugs. And then I'm going to break away from that and get a relationship. And I said, God told you this? And he said, yeah, I got it. And so I said, all right, look, why don't you pray and meditate, come back in a few days, see if you get the same message. And he did. And I thought, all right, I'm reading the book. The book says we're not the arbiter. This doesn't make any sense to me, but it's none of my business. I said, all right, let me know how it works, you know? And I'll be damned. That guy did it. He did it. And he's living in, I think, Iowa now. He's got a wife and three kids. It took him a couple years, but it just made no sense to me. And it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to.
That's shocking. I had a guy, and he ended up, he's bi, living in a relationship with a man and a woman, and that was his ideal. And everything within me was going, that can't be right. But I just, okay.
Yeah.
Like it's not up to me, you know, what suits somebody else, what fits their conscience, their goals, their, you know, go with God.
However, you may get the message, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, the next question is, we have several men here with less than a year. What are the two or three things you would have them carry away from this weekend?
One of these.
Yeah, the first thing would be a big book.
One of these would be good.
That'd be good, yeah. I would say that the first thing I would hope that they would carry away is the realization that they're not separate and apart. And probably mainly from that exercise that we did this afternoon. The laying on of the hands. The whispering of the messages in the ear. I've done that several times now, and I and several men, many men that I've watched, have had real deep experiences with that. And I think one of the key things, probably the grand illusion, the prime delusion of every alcoholic I've ever talked to has been this feeling of separation, this anxious apartness. And it's just not real, but it feels so real. And in addition to the fact that you're not separate and apart, you're not alone. You're here with us. I mean, people have talked about family issues. The book talks about the family afterward. It doesn't say it's going to be the biological family afterward. So, welcome to your family, man. Because you're in it right now.
Lots of phone numbers. There's some great men in this room. If you don't already have a sponsor, and chances are you're here because your sponsor grabbed you by the ear and dragged you all the way here anyway. But if you don't have a sponsor, don't leave here without one. It's not a marriage. You can get a new one in a month if it doesn't work out.
This one has your name on it.
That's not my name. That's Deeren's name.
You're assuming they know how to spell.
How much of your footwear, I don't know whether this is Cleveland or who, how much of your footwear choice is determined by your sponsor's influence?
I'll answer that for him, 100%.
What can I say? Please give us a practical exercise, thought to do as soon as we wake up in the morning. It's great. I didn't have a morning spiritual practice. I sat with my now sponsor in 2007 after he shared at a meeting and said, can you take me through what you do in the morning? And he sat me down. He opened up his iPad and he said, see all these daily readers? I read all of these daily readers. And then I think about some of the words in the daily readers and I meditate. And it takes me about half an hour and then I get into my day. He may or may not have said he said some prayers, I can't remember. But that's what I do. I don't read as many daily readers as he does. I read three or four. As I said, I think on Friday night I read page 101 of the 12 and 12 and I focus in on that word channel, the word grace and the word love. And I get connected. Some people might think I'm doing it wrong, but hey, I'm sober. I get in the shower and I hold out my hands while the hot water's rolling down my neck and I say my version of the third step prayer. I say my version of the seventh step prayer. And I've done it in the shower ever since I got sober. And I feel connected to my higher power every single day in that half an hour. And most days I'm able to take that out into the world. Steve?
Yeah, my suggestion is that you develop a spiritual practice. And it's your spiritual practice, not mine. You know, it's your tune. You're the one that's got to get into rhythm and harmony with it, not me. I can tell you what I do, but I got to tell you what I do is kind of OCD. It's bizarre, frankly. I do an evening review, like it talks about on page 86. And it's relatively short. I jot down some names and some things that I need to consider. Maybe I need to talk to my sponsor about it. Maybe I need to make an amends. But I have found that when I do my evening review, it's usually pretty much all your fault. Yeah, I have difficulty seeing my mistake, fault, and blame in the evening review. So I do it again in the morning. I take it out in the morning and I look at it in the morning. Now, interestingly, in the original manuscript, the evening review was actually done in the morning, not in the evening. So I look at that again and I got to decide whether I got to do something. I look to see if I've got recidivist actions. And by that I mean, character defects that keep coming up, because that means that's going to be a subject matter for my 11th step. Then what I do is, I guess similar to what Bob does, is I review a number of dailies and some other readings that I'm reading. And because I'm a little bit OCD, what I do is I take snippets out of those that I like to review again. And I put those on my iPad. And then I have a quiet period of time. I don't know how long it lasts, a few minutes, sometimes 20 minutes, where I basically have a conversation with God about the character defects that continue to show up in my life, with the understanding and appreciation that He will remove them in His time and on His schedule. And then I read again the readings that I've compiled, and then I pray and meditate about those. And then I review my day, and when I mean I review my day, I just basically look at what I'm going to do for the day. I don't look at the specific time schedule like I do once I get to work. I look at it like I'm going to work today. I got to call back these three alcoholics that I've been dealing with. My sponsee's going to do a fifth step. I've got this. I got the meeting tonight. You know, and sometimes I try to remind myself, like I had a real problem with sarcasm for a long time. I'm sure you never have guessed that.
No.
But I will remind myself of that, that I'm supposed to be patient, tolerant, loving, and understanding, that I'm supposed to not be a dick, okay? And then I basically send out those emails. I do an email of those condensed writings that I've done to a number of the guys that I sponsor, and they send it out to some other people. And I've been doing that for over 20 years. And then I go about my day. Now, the key is, when I go about my day, this took me about 10 or 12 years to realize this, what I was doing in the morning with this practice was I was doing in the morning and saying, okay, God, I got this. I'll check in with you tonight. And I went about my day. And now what I try to do, because I believe that once we've had a spiritual awakening, our job is to stay awake, I try to stay awake during the day. I try to be right here and right now. And that sounds simple, but it's actually, it's not, at least not for me. And that's what I focus on, and that's what I do. But the important thing is to do what's comfortable for you. I don't tell a guy, read the big book, read the Bible, read the Quran, read what makes sense to you. Again, it's like music. You'll find a practice that you're comfortable with. My one suggestion, though, is try to do something for at least 2 or 3 weeks to see if you've got some sync there, you know, to realize whether you like it or not. And then the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is you can change your mind. You can change your practice from time to time.
Anything else?
No. On footwear, though, Bob would never wear $50 runners like I was wearing this morning. So I just want to call that out.
The next question is, what is a grand sponsor? A grand sponsor is a wonderful older gentleman that sponsors your sponsor. And for some reason, we've decided to call those people grand sponsors, just like you could have a great grand sponsor. Bill here is my grunkle.
So, just like a grandfather, my sponsor's sponsor. Yeah?
Yeah.
What is the best way to get rid of lingering, heavy resentments? What if they're justified? Has there ever been one that isn't? And you don't want to let them go. Have you ever wanted to let any of them go? I think it's important to remember that I'm not alone. That's the first thing I need to remember. I'm not alone. Whilst, you know, I can read this book, I can go to page 65, 66, 67. I can work my way through that. I've got to be, especially with these heavy resentments, I've got to be talking about it with somebody else as well. There's a guy came up at my home group. We started a speaker meeting in Sydney with a reception line. Now, you'd think that a reception line's pretty, you know, that makes sense to me. Everyone should thank the speaker, but no, they don't. At the end of the speaker, I was the secretary of the group for a time, and I'd make the announcement that if you wanted to thank the speaker, they'd be standing at the front after the meeting if you'd like to come and thank them. And on one particular occasion, the speaker decided that he should go back over there somewhere and sit down rather than stand at the front where, you know, it was ordained that he should stand by me. And so after the meeting closed, I went over and he was in a conversation already with a gentleman. And I said, excuse me, gents, I can't think of his name. Would you mind coming? Yes, no worries. He didn't have a problem with it. And I went back to apologise to the other gentleman for interrupting them. And he just lost it big time. You're an effing rah, 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 rah. You're the most egomaniacal person I've ever met. Everyone hates you in AA. Everyone that I've ever spoken to thinks you're an a-hole. Now, it's one thing for one person to hate you. Oh! Oh! Jody would love that on the tape, Bob, so thank you for that. No, it wasn't. This was a man who was I held in high regard. I thought he had it all together. He was long-term sober. I really respected him. And when he said, and everyone thinks this, I'm like, so everyone who's long-term sober that's really respected by me have been gossiping behind my back about how much of an egomaniac I am. That's really cool. So I felt that that was a pretty justified resentment. I wrote about that. I talked about that. I wrote about that. I talked about that. I did the sick man prayer. And for clarity, Steve talked about the sick man prayer on Friday night, I think. It says, though we didn't like his symptoms, yeah, and the way they disturbed us, I was really disturbed. This was justified. They, like ourselves, comma, were sick too. What this resentment was doing was separating me from the rest of the human race. I'd made a judgment that he was wrong and I was right. I was up here, he was down there. And that little statement, they, like ourselves, brought us back together. He was one of God's kids who was having a bad day. Having a bad day, just like I have a bad day, like when I pulled that guy through the window of the car. It's like there's two rules, two sets of rules, one for me, one for everyone else. And the next sentence says, we asked God to help us. I've written me in my big book. Where's the problem if I'm resentful? It's not him. I've got the problem. So I need to pray for me. I'm asking God to help me bring pity, patience, tolerance, and love. I add the word love. And I needed to go and make amends to that man. And I did. Now, a lot of people don't think that we should make amends to everybody that we resent. It doesn't say that in the formal text, but it certainly says it in Bill's story. We make amends to everyone we've harmed or resented. And that was the only way I could shift that resentment, by going making amends to him. Steve?
Well, a couple of initial points. I just, you know, I have to say this as a lawyer, that pulling a gentleman out of the car is a bad day for him. It's assault and battery for you. Yeah. Just putting it out there, okay?
And like, also, like criminal and stuff.
I just a point of clarification. And I want to put on the record, because this is on the tape, that I don't care what they say about you, Darren. I love you, okay?
Thank you, Steve.
I just want to put that out there, okay? The best way to get rid of a lingering, heavy resentment. God. Alexander Pope once said, to err is human, to forgive is divine.
Mm.
And what he meant by that is we don't have the human power to forgive some of these huge monster resentments like my father. It's just not possible for me to forgive my father. We're going to spend some time tomorrow talking about acceptance and forgiveness because acceptance gets you half the way there. Mm. But the only remedy for a real big resentment is forgiveness. It's forgiveness. And the real problem with that is we don't normally have the human capacity to do it if it's a big, heavy resentment. Mm. And if they're justified, it doesn't make any difference if they're justified. Your perception of what happened is not relevant to you getting free of the resentment. And in some ways, it is an encumbrance to you getting rid of the resentment. Because he's off there doing whatever he's doing. The guy that said what he said to Darren, I guarantee you the next day wasn't thinking about Darren, but Darren was thinking about him. And that's what we do. And they rent space in our head, and they ain't paying for it. We are. We are. And we have to let it go. And the only way that most of us can let that go is through a higher power. Mm. What was the hardest thing you faced in sobriety, and how did you, are you getting through it? Wow. I think my father was the biggest thing, and I talked about that, you know, and that took a long time. That was probably the hardest thing, and it had an impact on every other relationship that I had. I didn't realize it at the time. How I got through it, I explained. I basically, because I had a sponsor that kept prompting me, he basically lured me into making an amends and eventually forgiving my father. And then it all went away. You know, that was probably the hardest thing that I've faced in sobriety. I mean, tomorrow I think we'll talk about some other things because I've had, if you've been here a while and you haven't died and you haven't drank, stuff happens. You know, if you're new, stuff happens. I remember when my sponsor, I was having a hard time and my sponsor was laughing and he said, there's good news and bad news. I'm like, all right, what's the bad news? He said, the bad news, Lamb, is it never ends. Great. What's the good news? He said the good news is the same as the bad news. It never ends, and you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. There's always something to do and somebody to do it with. And that's why I think on page 87, it talks about this, and on 86 it says that we're supposed to not drift into morbid reflection. My friend Bill, who takes credit for my talk from time to time, once said that awareness without humor is depression. Awareness without humor is depression.
I better check the question again. There's so many really difficult times. I've shared about a couple of them already. We'll share about a couple tomorrow when we're talking about forgiveness. There's been times in the last 28 years when I've wanted to stop certain behaviour, which you could easily go to other fellowships for. If you smoke, good luck to you. I wish you well, but I wanted to stop smoking and I couldn't. It was probably one of the hardest things that I needed to stop. And it was kind of the same answer that you gave to the last question. How did you do it? G-O-D. On one particular, I prayed to God, please make me violently ill every time I feel like a cigarette. That's how badly I wanted to end smoking cigarettes after 9 years in recovery, having stopped dozens of times. On one occasion, I was walking in the central business district of Sydney through the main mall section, hundreds of people coming and going to the office in the morning. And I, out of the corner of my eye, I saw one of those cigarette vendors and I had the thought to smoke. And I buckled over in two, like completely right angles in the middle, wearing my suit and tie. And I knew it was on. I knew there was no defence. I knew I was walking over in that direction. And exactly where I was in the middle of that mall, I got on my knees and bowed my head and I started to pray like my life depended on it. Now that might sound extreme, but at that point in my sobriety, I wanted to get that done, so much so that I didn't care what anyone else thought about me. Let's go to the next question.
Let me talk about that a little bit more. I was thinking about another practical example. I talked about this sarcasm issue that I had, and I recognized it. You know, and I'm not talking, by the way, like a subtle comment or two. I mean, I'm just eviscerating people. I'm gutting them, and I feel bad about it. But apparently not bad enough to stop doing it, right? Because I'm still doing it. And I'm writing inventory and I'm talking to Michael about it and I'm making amends because I'm a jackass. I put a note up on my mirror. Don't be a dick. Didn't work. You know, I kept doing it and I kept doing it. And I was really having a hard time with this. And one day my grand sponsor at the time, Scott, called me and read inventory to me. Freaked me out. That's not how it's supposed to happen, right? I'm supposed to be reading inventory up, not down. This is, I don't know where I got this idea, but he read this inventory to me. And I asked him, I said, why are you doing this? And he said, well, this is part of my sixth and seventh step practice. This is one of the ways that I practice humility. It helps keep me right-sized, basically, to read inventory to people in my sponsorship line. And then he said, you've been having a problem with sarcasm, right? I said, yeah. He goes, you might want to try it. And I agreed with him. But I didn't do it. And this went on for another couple months, and it was extraordinarily painful. And then I started reading inventory to men that I sponsor about my sarcasm. And it didn't stop immediately, but I can tell you that constant contact with you gradually ground out the rough edges of my personality. And it didn't go away perfectly, as you can tell by this weekend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's that's fair. But trust me, it's way better than it was. Way better than it was. And there's something about sharing that with someone that you're sponsoring, because now I'm not the teacher. Now I'm not the, you know, now I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous that has a problem just like you do. And I got to tell you, what I found was that not only helped me, but that freed them up. And they got better relationships with the guys that they sponsor. And that's a common thing that we do in my home group area. And it's been very helpful.
Mm. I want to add a couple of things to that. I talked about rage. I talked about sexual abuse, talked about trauma. We'll talk about forgiveness around some of that stuff tomorrow, which might help a couple of people. But there's other stuff that, you know, I've done to try and, unwittingly my ego's tried to back me out the door. You know, I had so many secrets, at two different points in my sobriety. Stuff that I wasn't sharing with anyone, not sharing with my sponsor. I remember writing this massive inventory about porn and other stuff that I was doing that I wasn't proud of, that I really wanted to stop and just couldn't stop. And I spent an entire day in a chapel reading it and rereading it and crying my eyes out and begging God to remove it. And I needed to do the share it with the higher power bit first before I took it to my sponsor, because I couldn't get clear enough to be able to take it to my sponsor until I did that part. And that's really unusual. But that's how far removed I was from being able to get honest with that man that I had to go and do it with God first. And I got the message from God, it's okay, you're not the only one. And I went and shared it with my sponsor. And he said, how are you still sober? I haven't repeated that activity since that day. It was removed.
Did you grab one?
I did grab one,
okay.
But it's a funny one. So okay. It's attention, Darren. It says, why does Steve talk so funny?
It's a congenital defect.
I don't think you do.
Yeah.
I think you're talking quite well.
Thank you.
So
appreciate that.
I can't answer that.
Okay. Okay. This is a good question. How do you start to work with a new sponsee who has 10 years or more? It depends. It depends on if they've gone through the steps or not. I've got a couple guys that I've been working with. One guy doesn't have quite 10 years. He just got 9 years. I started working with him at 8 years. He had never read the book. He had never read the book. And I don't mean read it with anybody else. I mean he had never read the book. So we started at the beginning and went through the book the same way that my sponsor went through it with me. Now I have, over time I've acquired sponsees who their sponsor has died or moved away or for whatever reason, and they've got substantial sobriety. They've worked the steps. I don't go through the very beginning with them unless they would like to do that. But what I do ask them to do is to either give me a fifth step or what I would call like a tenth step on steroids, because I have to understand you if I'm going to sponsor you. And we're going to have this interchange, this spiritual consent that my friend Charlie talks about, so that we can have this conversation. And if I don't know who you are, if I don't know what's been rocking your boat and driving your train and keeping you up at night for the last 2 or 3 years, then we're not going to have a relationship at all. And I've had several guys that won't do that. But that's what I do. And once we go through that process, then we can have an understanding of our relationship.
Someone who's been sober a while?
Yeah, 10 years.
Yep. I used to have a rule which was just for me because I was afraid that I wasn't doing it right, sponsoring. I'd just say, look, if it's all right with you, we should just go through the book. I don't always have the time for that today. And I think out of that need of I don't have the time to take every individual person through the book one-on-one at every juncture of my life, I started to ask, if we went through the 12 steps together, just in our mind here over the next 5 minutes, where do you think you're at?
Keep talking.
And a lot of the time... That's some MacGyver shit right there. And the book's green too. Like, this is green beret shit, isn't it?
It's a special book.
I actually thought what he was doing was he was coming alongside and doing the book on the side, and he was going to do that and snap my neck. But you know how you've seen that one with a book on the Steven Seagal movies? More often than not, what's happened is they haven't finished their ninth step. More often than not. They've got incomplete amends. I've got a specific way that I was shown how to create an eight-step inventory. Now, not many people in the US write an eight-step inventory. It comes out of the UK. The guy who took me through the book was sponsored by a gentleman who was a member of the Joys of Recovery in London, and they draw up a four-column inventory for the eighth step, who I resent. That's the other inventory. Who I harmed, what I did, what area of self I harmed and go to the 12 and 12 and Bill points out physical, mental, spiritual, financial. And then the fourth column is, how would you feel if they or somebody else did something similar to you? And I got handed a list of 100 feelings and I was told to scan them. And if you think about that process for a minute, it doesn't take you too long to imagine how that might make you willing. It might enable some empathy for these people that we've harmed to start to imagine how you'd feel. So if they haven't finished their ninth step, I push them through the eight-step inventory, get them willing, and we start picking off the next items on the list.
I think it's your turn.
Thank you. I feel funny, like there's nothing for me to do now. Like I have to actually be present. It's, whew. What does fourth dimension mean to you? I almost want to let the lawyer go first, but I'll go first. We've been talking about the spiritual realm. We've been talking about connecting to our true self. Once I drop into spirit, to be able to connect to the great spirit. My concept is, and you know, Bob very rightly says, we're not here to talk about our concept of God, we're here to talk about our experience of God. But seeming you've asked, I believe that's the fourth dimension. I believe that, you know, there's a third dimensional physical realm, and then the fourth dimension is that spiritual internet that I can connect with the great power, that I can connect with that knowledge by dropping into spirit. Steve?
The fourth dimension is your natural state of being. And if you're new, you may not realize it yet. You probably can't demonstrate it, but it exists. It's the great reality that exists within each of us. Whether you call it the spark of the divine, it doesn't matter what you call it. It's your natural state of being, which is that which is out of self. We have been trained over time to think only of ourselves. And when we get out of that state, when we start thinking of others, that is our natural state of being. And that's where the freedom comes in, when we're actually of service. And that doesn't seem to make any sense when I'm new. But when you've been around here a while and you practice this, you come to realize that the less I think of me and the more I think of you, the closer I am to whatever this concept of God is, and the more readily I am able to experience it. When does religion and politics become inappropriate at the meeting? Before or after or just during? Well, it can be inappropriate, all of the above.
Mm.
You know, it depends. I mean, if you're in the parking lot and you're just talking to a friend, you can have any conversation that you want. But if you're really having a conversation that is going to involve a meeting or a group or Alcoholics Anonymous or some type of guidance or direction that you're giving to someone, I believe that our traditions tell us we should try to keep religion and politics out of it. Now, having said that, you obviously are going to have questions with a guy about what his religion is, if he has one. And if he has one, generally, we try to encourage him to keep doing that because that's a good thing. You know, it's none of our business, but it is our business because we want them to be comfortable with whatever they're doing. Can you have a conversation with another AA member about politics? Of course you can. Just not in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you have a conversation with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous about a religion? Absolutely. But not in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, your religion and your politics are irrelevant. Just my opinion, but I think it's a pretty good one.
Yeah. The only thing I've got to add is that I left my AA police badge at home. And it would come out regularly when this stuff used to happen at my home group. There's no place for it at all. That's for you, my friend.
What does that say?
Do you want to read the next one while we try?
All right, I'll read the next one while we try to decide. How many are you currently sponsoring? That's an easy question. About half. I stole that from Howard Pullins, but it's a really good answer.
You might be connected. What you are now connected to has always been there.
Steve, do you think that much of what you are now connected to has always been there and you are now returned to? Yes. Yes. And I believe that it's there for every man in this room, too. And I think that one of our jobs is to try to get people to realize it. You know, tomorrow we're going to talk about acceptance and forgiveness, and then the last session is going to be all as well. Where we're going to try to convince you that despite all outward appearances, all is well. And I remember Sandy Beach one time told me that his primary job that he thought he had as a sponsor was to convince or try to convince the men that he sponsored that their perception of reality might not be accurate. Despite all outward appearances, all is well.
Mm.
And I think that's all the questions we have. Do you have any other comments?
All I'd like to do is answer that question. I love Howard's answer, by the way. But mine's a little bit different.
Oh, sure. I'm sorry.
How many are you currently sponsoring? It's not about the number that I want to talk about. It's about a contract that I have with somebody in my life about how many I'm sponsoring. My wife and I have a number for me. Believe it or not, I'm not allowed to exceed that number because I'm stealing her time. Now that's pretty difficult, you know, when you've got a new guy in front of you and you've, you know, talked to him at the door for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. He's in tears, you're in tears, and he says, will you be my sponsor? I can't say no, but I've got to go home and report in. And usually what I do is today I try and, you know, you, Steve, as well, no doubt, will have a number of sponsees that you're trying to get them sponsoring others. So most of the men that ask me to sponsor them, I try and think of who within my sponsorship tree or the home group would be a good fit for them because my ego doesn't need any more. Yeah? I collect stuff. I've been walking around here this weekend looking for what rock exactly I'd like to take home. I collect rocks. And my ego had been collecting sponsees for a time. One of my sponsors, every time I rang him with a problem, would say, what you need to do is go and get a new sponsee. That worked for a time. A lot of the time, how many? Too many. I'm not doing them justice if I don't have time for them. I'm not doing my wife justice if I'm stealing time from her to give to somebody else. I certainly aren't doing the relationship with my kids justice. I'm stealing time from my work. So sometimes too many.
Yeah, along that vein, there was a question earlier about what do you do with a man that's gone through the 12 steps. And I think that the greatest gift that you can give a sponsee that you have is a new man. Is a new man. You know, when you find somebody that's, I mean, and the worse off they are, the better. You know, and you take him up to that guy and you give him to your sponsee and you just handed him a divine distraction. There you go.
Yep. I don't know whether we're on time or not. I just had a crazy thought. Some people may not have been comfortable to put questions in the basket, but they may want to ask a question from the floor. Are we on time, Barclay, or? We've got 10 minutes, so any questions from the floor? Yep, down here.
Steve. Is there also, say, an educational variety, or is like suicidal thoughts and that the prerequisite?
Look, I can answer that.
You should repeat it.
Yep. With second surrender, is there an educational variety of that, or is it always, you know, a catastrophe, suicidal type? And I suppose for the tape, why is there no third, fourth, and fifth? They don't want to scare you. They just call it second, but it's actually got the word S on the end of surrender. Because it's plural. In my personal experience, I haven't been suicidal with most of these, but they've all been pretty catastrophic. These, you know, I described today when I left that job, it was like I was drugged and the world came up and hit me on the side of the head. I'd call that catastrophic. It needs to be for my ego to be smashed. I don't know whether you've got a different point of view, Steve.
No, I think that some people just don't like the word surrender, but there are multiple times when you have to let go of what you think is real. Sometimes you can realize that in an educational way. Usually we have to be hit about the head and shoulders, either physically or emotionally, before we come to that realization. And it's interesting, you know, does the realization come before the pain, during the pain, or immediately after the pain? I don't know that it matters. What matters is that you have the realization and hopefully change the behavior.
Probably got time for one more or two more. Anyone? Yep, down the back. David.
We're just filling it for a while.
The question is what realizations or surprises have come to us throughout this last 2-year worldwide pandemic. I don't know that there have been surprises in relation to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's certainly been the realization that Alcoholics Anonymous is as alive and vibrant as ever and that we appear to be extraordinarily adaptable.
Mm.
You know, despite the fact that many people didn't like Zoom, it was there, it was utilized. It affords an accessibility and an availability that was not present before. And I think Bill Wilson would be thrilled by it. On the other hand, there's been a real need and a desire for in-person. You know, you cannot do the exercise that we did this afternoon on Zoom. Mm. It is impossible. And we are physical, tactile people. You know, we've always searched for things. And we need that contact. And I am so glad that we're able to do that and that I've been invited to participate in this weekend. I've been here many times before and I was so looking forward to this and it's been absolutely wonderful. How about you, Darren? Mm.
What really surprised me and I'm not saying that it works perfectly, but men and women coming to Alcoholics Anonymous on the Zoom platform or, you know, whatever digital format platform, and they actually got sober. And they're actually staying sober. That was shocking. It really was. And then when we opened back up, one guy, I got to give him his 6-month chip, and it was the first time I met him. It was the first time I met him. It was just beautiful. Yeah.
You want to cry a little more, or do you want to stop now?
One, two, three. Bill.
Let me know how that works out for you. Because you'll be on it, brother.
Ben.
Have you ever, since you got sober in a period of time, have you ever felt like you lost God or went through a period when you were absolutely angry at God?
Yeah, 100%. For the benefit of the tape, have you ever, in sobriety, felt like you've lost God or got really, really angry at God? When I was standing in that hospital room at 6 years sober holding a dead baby, I was pretty freaking angry at God. When she left, I was pretty darn angry at God. There were lots of times. However, you know, Sandy used to tell us, as soon as you're ready, get back on the pony. It doesn't matter. God doesn't hold grudges. Just as soon as you're ready, get back on the pony. God's waiting for you. He's still loving on you anyway, whether you're not loving on him or not. And start praying as soon as you can.
When my daughter Ashley died, I was very, very upset with God. And I was really having a conversation with the God of my understanding that was very nasty. And I was pissed. And I kind of knew that that was not the way I should be talking to God. And I remember I was talking to Michael and Scott about it, and they both told me that God would rather have me yell at God than not talk to him at all. So I continued to yell until I just ran out of gas. You know, and I realized that what I thought was real wasn't real. You know, and I'm so grateful that those two men didn't tell me I was being a jackass. They just let me come to my own realization. Because if you'd have said that to me at the time, it would not have gone well for you. You know, they had the understanding, they had the experience to allow me to have my experience.
That must be close, Barclay.